that one of the two commissions that Schmidt chairs, and it advises Congress on ways that it can increase its uses of technology, particularly AI, but not exclusively AI. And it's all framed in this yellow peril language of China is on the verge of beating Silicon Valley in the technology race that began in Silicon Valley. So basically the narrative is, you know, American innovation is responsible for these technologies. Of course, Silicon Valley takes much of the credit, but as we know, a lot of it comes from public research and a lot of it comes from military research. But because China does not have the same privacy concerns, indeed, you have a government that is erecting a high-tech surveillance state. And because China has leapfrogged over a lot of what this report calls sort of legacy structure, so they go directly to cashless digital payments. They are going directly to telehealth because there's a big shortage of doctors.
Naomi, we have 20 seconds.
Yeah. So basically, the idea is China is leaping ahead of the United States, and the only way to fight back is to have a China-style surveillance state here in the United States. And that's the message that Schmidt has been peddling for a long time now.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. There's so much more in the piece, and people can read it. We will link to it. Naomi Klein, senior correspondent at The Intercept, the new piece, Green New Deal, under cover of mass death. Andrew Cuomo calls in the billionaires to build a high-tech dystopia. Naomi is the author of many books, including The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of...
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 o'clock a.m. Time for more talk radio with Paul Rowland. Stay tuned.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve?
And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and this is the second Wednesday of the month with my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. So you probably heard, actually, if you're listening to Democracy Now!, the preceding program, yesterday they had on the Yankton Sioux tribal chairman, Harold Frazier, who was talking about what we're going to talk about today. 4 years after the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle burst on the national scene in North Dakota, we have another major fight over indigenous sovereignty breaking out in South Dakota, with Trump-supporting Governor Kristi Noem threatening legal action against the Cheyenne River and Pine Ridge Oglala Sioux tribes over their checkpoints on highways going through their tribal land. So, well, with that, I welcome Yankton Sioux and Dene, Navajo writer, activist, and Second Wednesday Talk Radio co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Hey, this is Sonny, the engineer. We don't have Jackie yet, so just keep going, Paul.
Okay. Let me Facebook her and remind her of the phone number at the studio as I speak. So, yeah, this is a crazy, crazy time we're living in, and with the lack of federal response, federal coordination, which is absolutely scandalous, and we're still trying to figure out exactly what their end game is, other than death and destruction and chaos, and holding desperately on to the power that they have. States have been left largely on their own to address this pandemic with the limited state resources and the limited ability to go into debt that states have, which is unfortunately in a lot of ways playing into the Trumpistas' hands. So So it's sort of breaking down along blue and red state lines, the way that this pandemic is being addressed, with many of the Republican governors opening up their states, opening up both economically and to the resurgence of the pandemic seemingly. And a lot of blue states, a lot of Democratic governors like our own Kate Brown playing a more cautious approach and trying more along the lines of protecting lives and health over strictly economic concerns. Now we throw in the Native issue, because obviously Native nations, indigenous nations, have a completely different juridical status with regards to the federal government, more akin to the states, but in a lot of ways supposedly above the states. I say supposedly because their sovereignty has been limited by both de facto actions and legal precedents and such. So I'm just finishing typing in this. Hopefully Jackie will see it.
We have Jackie on the line.
We have Jackie. Oh, great. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
I don't know if you heard my introduction. I basically just said that 4 years after the Dakota Access struggle broke upon the national scene, here we are back in the Dakotas with another major conflict over indigenous sovereignty. You want to tell us what's going on there?
Yes. Yeah. So I have been on Monday. Since we've been in the lockdown for the coronavirus, I've been me and the editors from Pollination Magazine. We've been doing three times a week. We've been doing podcasts covering the coronavirus in Indian Country, and so we've had guests on every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and talking. And it's amazing. We've done 20 episodes so far. And it was just always a topic every single, we could do more basically. And so, so on Monday I got to interview, the chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, Harold Frazier, on the podcast. And we also had, on the podcast, South Dakota State Legislature, Red Dawn Foster, who is, she's Ogallala Lakota, and she serves in the state legislature. And she was one of the 17 legislators who, bipartisan group of legislators in South Dakota state capitol, who basically wrote a letter to the governor, saying that they didn't support this sort of heavy-handedness with the tribes. And talking to Harold Frazier, he's determined to, he was a big leader at Standing Rock as well, because he was chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is adjacent to Standing Rock, just due south. And that it's the largest extant Lakota reservation that we have, and so it's but he was a very strong voice of Standing Rock, and continues to be in this regard, and says that they're going to continue to do this because they need to, because they have very few hospital beds, and their population is very vulnerable in many ways, and what they call comorbidities, and so they want to protect them. And so the checkpoint is, and we are trying to upload our podcast to YouTube right now, and we have a lot of video of the actual checkpoints, and he was on CNN on Monday as well, and talking to Sarah Sidner. And she actually went through the process on national television of being asked the questions that they ask folks when they come through the reservation. And these are basically, they just ask them, if they're sick, if they have a cough, what their purpose is, and if it's not necessary, then they're advised to drive around the reservation. And so, but most people, are not interrupted. I also had on the podcast yesterday, Avis Little Eagle, who is the publisher of the Teton Times, which is located in Standing Rock, but they also distribute on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation, and she said that her publication has had no problem getting permission to come and do deliveries of the newspaper. So if you have business there, they're not going to stop you from doing it, but they will check to see, you know, I think they even check your temperature to see. So it's just to make sure that you're not bringing the virus, you're, as well as they can tell, and also that your business is necessary on the reservation. So we also spoke to Arizona State University law school professor, and formerly he was here based in Portland with Lewis and Clark Law School, Bob Miller, who has written extensively on sovereignty issues, and he agreed that they were on pretty solid footing as far as legal precedent goes with federal Indian law, and and the letter is, you know, spells out a lot of that legal letter that the 17 state legislatures sent to the governor, spells out pretty clearly that legal precedent, which is actually is based in a ruling that actually the Rosebud Sioux Tribe appealed a state of South Dakota lower court ruling that said that that the state had jurisdiction over the roads on the reservation under Public Law 280, which was a law that gave some states jurisdiction over, limited jurisdiction over tribes.
And it's also in the treaty language, right?
Yes, they also cited the Fort Laramie treaties, and but in this case, they took it to higher court, to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the tribe won. The Rosebud Sioux Tribe won that case in 1990, and basically the court pretty unequivocally stated that the state had no jurisdiction over the roads going onto the reservation. So it's pretty clear. There was one case that from Montana versus I think versus the United States, where Montana, the state of Montana, was suing the federal government for the right to challenging tribal jurisdiction, and that there was state was acknowledged, actually, oh, it basically challenged the right of tribes to have jurisdiction over non-natives, and this is where Professor Miller thought that the governor might make her strongest argument, Governor Noem, that they are exerting jurisdiction over non-natives, which is there's some very negative precedents that in that regard. They lost that case with the Montana versus U.S. case, and that set the precedent. But there is an exception in that ruling, and that exception is for health or emergencies. And so where there's a risk to the community, then the tribe under that ruling can exert jurisdiction, which he certainly felt, Professor Miller felt, that this definitely fell under that, being a worldwide pandemic.
So. Yeah, it's not as if these are just sort of arbitrary. It's not like they're just trying to flex their power arbitrarily. Paramount goal is to protect their own health. And as Fraser said, the tribal chairman, they're really vulnerable. And so this is one of the important tools in a toolbox that they can actually wield to stop the spread into their communities and preventing it from becoming, the possibility of becoming a big crisis is probably even greater than a lot of other places because of the lack of, as you said, hospital facilities.
Yes, and on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation, which is, like I said, the largest intact reservation of the Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota peoples, it's their population is highly at risk as far as comorbidities, and then also the lack of facilities. They only have 8 beds in the local Indian Health Service hospital. None of them will offer services in case of acute cases of coronavirus. So they actually would have to be taken 3 hours away to Rapid City, South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're at much a greater risk, and they just want to reduce the chance of that. And so the chance of that happening to their population. So they and these are a lot of these are structural problems that come from, you know, a really unfair colonizing force from the United States government itself. And so the Indian Health Service, which is actually one of our country's few national health services, is very underfunded. So it's but it has, I think, you know, looking at the Navajo Nation in particular, which I've done a lot of looking at in my podcast series, the Navajo Nation has access to far more testing than most of the country, it appears. They tested a huge proportion of their population and are on track to, you know, really outperform the majority of states. I know that Salt Lake City Tribune looked at it, and they found that if the Navajo Nation was a state, that they would have the third highest testing rate, per capita testing, in the country. And so I think what I see a lot is that with this combination of Indian Health Service, a public national health service for the Navajo Nation and every other tribe, federally recognized tribe in the United States, that combined with sort of a cultural sort of focus on the community, on supporting the community, on standing together, and taking the science seriously. Often in these red states, the native nations within these red states take the virus far more seriously than the governors or the, like you see with Governor Noem, she has not declared an official stay-at-home order. There are certain limitations on meetings, schools have been let out, but generally people can still go shop. It's left up to the individual to decide what to do. And so,
and she was letting the meatpacking industry totally off the hook early on, which led to a huge outbreak.
Yeah, there was over 900 cases there, and this is a hot spot located in the far eastern side of the state, in the city of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and which is the largest city in South Dakota, and many of the folks who work at these meat packing plants are immigrants, particularly from Africa, and so they are quite vulnerable. And I was listening to one interview, actually I think on the New York Times podcast, and you know, this woman, you know, this is a job where she could get health care, make a good salary and support her children, and there's a large community, immigrant community there that all work at the plant. I think they're from Somalia, and but I do think that, you know, there was an article recently, and this is a bit dark, but in the Atlantic Monthly, where they felt that once Trump understood that the virus was mostly impacting communities of color, right, disproportionately, he began to take it less seriously, you know. And So there's this feeling that it's their problem, and I think that when I'm looking at what's happening on even the Navajo Nation, you know, you see all these news reports. It's great to get national coverage about the infrastructure problems on the reservation. You know, the Navajo Nation has, you know, many people don't have running water or you know, indoor plumbing, right? My grandparents didn't have it until this century, basically, right? So it's so that means it's difficult for them to have access to clean water. And this is, of course, you know, this is U.S. policy in a sense that they're not funding infrastructure on the reservation. The goal, of course, is to drive Native people off the reservation so we abandon our land claims and our political existence, right, as nations within the United States. And you see a similar thing happening in Puerto Rico, really, where they're not rebuilding, where they are basically sort of encouraging the brown Spanish-speaking community to flee, to leave, to depopulate it. You know, if you look at the Northwest Territories ruling, you know, the goal was to basically, once the territory had enough white people, then they could apply for statehood, right? So there's this notion that states need to be majority white, right? Majority English speaking. And so you get Hawaii and Puerto Rico, and Puerto Rico is far closer to the United States, but can't get statehood because it's too brown and too Spanish speaking. And it's Hawaii, you know, they were admitted, and the Native Hawaiians there are fighting for their sovereignty to this day. because they were an independent nation. So it's it plays into all these different aspects, and I'm really glad to see that being reported. But the issue is that very rarely does that reporting end up in actually getting funding from Congress to address these issues. I mean, it would cost billions of dollars to put in a modern water system. You know, the Navajo Nation has a lot of water claims, but with water claims, you have to use them. So they don't have the ability to use their claims. And there's been a lot of water theft going on, going back to the Goldwater era, where he and actually working, there's a really great book about this where he worked with the mafia and with the Mormon church to basically steal water from by creating this Navajo Hopi land dispute and then putting in the Central Arizona Project, which is one of the largest infrastructure projects the U.S. government has ever funded. And which
let's,
just
let's take a little pause. Let's take a little pause. Yeah. We've gone in a lot of different areas here. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and my co-host, who you're listening to, is Jacqueline Keeler, who's a Yankton Sioux and Diné or Navajo, a writer and activist here locally, and my second Wednesday co-host here on Wednesday Talk Radio. There's an awful lot to unpack. I know these are really critical issues. Obviously, it seems like all the contradictions are coming out and being heightened during this pandemic, and so it's almost inevitable that all these historical tensions and conflicts are gonna reappear in various ways, including the original conflict stemming from the colonization of these lands. One thing I just want to read a little bit of Ruth Hopkins, who you may probably know of as a Sistan Wahpeton Sioux writer, has an article recently in The Appeal, and there's a really interesting paragraph. But one of the things that Governor Noem, Kristi Noem in South Dakota, says is that the tribe didn't actually consult with the state on these checkpoints.
I cover that. I cover that in my podcast quite extensively, which hopefully I will have up very soon. I spoke to state legislator Red Dawn Foster, who is actually the daughter of she is Lakota and Navajo like I am, and she's the daughter of Navajo AIM leader Lenny Foster, and she is one of the first women to hold the position she's holding in the state legislature. And she said that the governor did not consult with the legislators about this. They were totally, in fact, even as, and she did not, I spoke to Chairman Frazier, and he said that in no way were they didn't even, I spoke to both Chairman Frazier, and I also heard an interview on Indian.com with President Bear Runner of the Oglala Sioux Tribe. The Oglala Sioux Tribe and the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe are the two, my cat is going crazy in here. I'm sorry. Are the two Lakota reservation tribes in South Dakota who have checkpoints up, and neither of them even received a copy of a letter. They had to read about it in the news. So she didn't actually send the letter to any of the tribal leaders. She sent it to the media. And of course,
this is an issue. This whole issue of consultation is loomed really large in the Dakota Access Pipeline issue, similarly.
The issue with this, is that it appears that with Governor Kristi Noem, she used to be the congresswoman from South Dakota there, and she was called when she served in Congress the world's most powerful intern because she was still finishing her college degree while she was in office. And now she's the governor of South Dakota, but she still wants to return, according to some of the reporting coming out of South Dakota, that she wants to return to Washington, D.C., and she also wants to work in the Trump administration. And so she's positioning herself to get his attention. And she's actually being advised by Corin Lewandowski, who is the former Trump campaign manager. And so he is the one who, according to reporters, at the state capitol in South Dakota, he is the one who is actually encouraging her to do this. Let me see if I can find the quote. She basically is encouraging to seek out conflict and basically to make her name that way nationally.
Mm-hmm. So let me give the number to call in if you're interested in joining this conversation, 503-231-8187. We're talking about specifically an issue in South Dakota where the Cheyenne River and Pine Ridge Oglala Sioux tribes have instituted checkpoints on the roads entering their lands, their reservations, and just asking questions of motorists coming through, whether they've got any symptoms, whether they're just passing through, whether they have business there, and it's become a national issue with the governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, challenging those and threatening legal action, which we talked about Jackie mentioned at the beginning. There's some case law upholding strongly tribes' right to regulate traffic through their reservations. But before going on, I just want to quickly read this to say that the issue, it goes both ways, apparently, this consultation. And as I said, that Kristi Noem accused the tribes of actually not consulting.
Let me just read these few sentences here. I would rather give the actual stuff that I have for my stuff, and I think I would rather do that for my own reporting. Focus on that. So
fine, go ahead.
Okay. So what I found out when I was interviewing, with the interview with President Bear Runner, he said that they actually had consultation with the state on April 16th, and they spoke to state representatives, and they were told, they gave them their plan to do these checkpoints, and they had no problem with it. And in fact, when I spoke to citizens of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, that they told me that, and I got this confirmed from Chairman Frazier when I interviewed him on Monday. They confirmed that the county sheriff, the white county sheriff, is working with the tribe to do these checkpoints. So they are working collaboratively, and their checkpoints have received approval in a sense from different state representatives. And speaking to state senator Red Dawn Foster, she said that on top of that, they were actually that they had had a meeting before with the governor, with Governor Noem, and she had been had told them what actually there was a legislator from that county in North Dakota, in South Dakota, where the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is, had actually brought forward his issues with the checkpoints, and she had told him at the time that that the law basically supported the tribe's right to do that. And so this is a 180 degree turn for her, and it came out of the blue, not only to state legislators and state officials and county officials, but it doesn't meet the consultation aspect of it. That is obvious. And tribes as sovereign nations have consultation rights with the federal government, technically, and of course preferably with the state government. And when I had the Teton Times publisher Avis Little Eagle, and she's also a tribal council member there at Standing Rock, and the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe goes over two states, North Dakota and South Dakota. And she said that their relationship with the North Dakota governor, Borgum, is like night and day. He calls them every day. They have meetings. They're constantly in contact with the governor himself. And they have received a lot of support for testing. They just did this massive testing of nearly, I think, 400 people, just for anybody who wanted to come up on the reservation in Standing Rock on the North Dakota side. They were unable to get that kind of support from South Dakota. And Chairman Frazier said that he has never met with the governor, and the meeting had occurred with the Oglala Sioux Tribe, but had not occurred with the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I want this whole thing about the 17 state legislators, that seems to be something new. Because, I mean, historically, from what I understand, South Dakota has been very, very racist, like almost across the board, and anti-Native. It seems like something of a new development that there's actually there's support. How much do you think that has to do with the fact that there is a Native state legislator, or that just times are changing?
Yeah, it's definitely times are changing, I think. Well, talking to State Senator Foster, she said that the 17 legislators are bipartisan, so they're not just Democrats, and that they give a very strong statement supporting and citing the legal reasons why the tribes have jurisdiction over the roads. They actually cite the case of Rosebud Sioux Tribe versus South Dakota. So yeah, uh-huh. I think there was a huge number of Native women, particularly who ran in the 2018 midterms elections and got elected, and certainly Red Dawn Foster is one of them, so it's hopefully we'll get more. She was definitely encouraging more participation. She noted that Governor Noem won the governorship through only 10,000 votes, and that was well within the ability of the different tribal citizens in South Dakota to deliver. They have a far larger pool of voters, mostly Democratic voters, and if they can get out the vote, then they can definitely defeat her again. It's and of course, but to get out in my, I have an article that is in Sierra Magazine right now, where I was on assignment in January for 2 weeks on the Navajo Nation, looking at the get out the vote effort there, and they were the rural Utah project was going quite gangbusters there. I talked to a couple of Navajo women who were working with them, and they were registering. You know, they had a goal of something like, I can't remember, like 1,000 voters a week to register on the Navajo Nation, and because they're also going into Arizona as well, as they had registered quite a number of voters during the midterms in 2018, and I think they had a special election in 2019 as well, and so they're looking forward to doing that on the Navajo Nation. But of course, with these stay-at-home orders being strictly enforced, particularly on the reservations, registration has been very difficult. But I know that they are supporting, in South Dakota, many legislators are supporting vote by mail, and which is a new thing. It wasn't something that they would have considered before.
Well, it's with Jared Kushner now basically floating the idea that there may not be elections in the fall, which is very scary thought, and not surprising to those of us who see what the Trumpistas are doing, but also with the possibility of this COVID having a resurgence in the fall. It just the uncertainties are just dramatic, and so it seems like what people are doing now, these are really crucial to actually the functioning of democracy. Being an election year, the public health measures that are being taken seem really crucial. I'm just putting it out there. You can respond, but let me just check in with Sonia and see if we've got any callers yet.
One person, they declined to come on air, but they did suggest that perhaps, you know, on the U.S. colonized land, emulate tribal authorities and institute road checkpoints and just check on folks who are traveling about and like that.
That's an interesting thought. That would certainly stir up those liberate folks even more than they already are. You can respond to what I just said, but I also wanted to. So, have there been any? Do you know, Jackie? Have there been any serious incidents at these checkpoints? There been any, or provocations? Have you heard anything about that?
Yeah. So they. I haven't heard that. They said that it's quite, Chairman Fraser described it as being, you know, he said in South Dakota they have a lot of road construction, and people get stopped all the time to you know, to follow a pilot car. He said it's really nothing more than that, you know, level of disruption, and no, they haven't had any problems with that at all. So they I think that like I said, my theory, and of course this is just a theory based on reporting being done at the, you know, by reporters on the ground there in Pierre, South Dakota, in the capital, but this is a stunt. This is a stunt being done to attract national attention. We have here in Governor Kristi Noem sort of another version of Sarah Palin, and so she is the governor angling for a larger profile nationally, and she knows that by doing these actions that she can get the get eyes on her, and she can also get the get support from folks like these Liberate States folks, and also she's doing this in a performance for Trump as well. So to her, I would say that, you know, she obviously knows the law, because she told, you know, just a couple weeks ago she knew the law, right? And so and she knew that it wasn't in the state's favor. One of the things that the state legislators said was that they actually that they did not want to spend to waste their taxpayers' money on a lawsuit, right? And there was a lot of questions about whether the National Guard was, she was going to call it the National Guard or not. And I got assurances from State Senator Foster that she had just come from a meeting, and that they definitely not going to call up the National Guard, but that they are going to, that she wants to do a lawsuit. The governor wants to follow up with a lawsuit which they should lose, unless, of course, the danger that some people see, of course, is sending it to the Supreme Court, getting it appealed up there. And of course, the Supreme Court is right now quite conservative, and may decide to create some new sort of interpretation of precedent, which would not go well for tribes.
Mm-hmm. And so speaking of the Liberate people, as I mentioned at the outset, obviously this total lack of any federal coordination, which is just mind-boggling, and is leading to total chaos and competition and all the kinds of things that aren't needed in this pandemic. But right now, there's a lawsuit that's against Oregon Governor Kate Brown by 15 evangelical churches, three of the state's most conservative legislators, a law firm with decade-long ties to anti-LGBTQ legal campaigns, and Grant County Sheriff Glenn Palmer, who you know well from a Malheur standoff. So once again, we see these battle lines being drawn, and immense amounts of resources going to be wasted at a time when we don't need them, which is, either they're trying to score political points, or it's grandstanding, or there's obviously this deep-seated ideological divide that's going on.
Yeah, I would say the federal response has obviously not been great. One of the things that Red Dawn Foster brought up actually was the issue of the economic costs that South Dakota is facing. And even though they have not shut down their economy the way other states have done, there has been a huge loss. And she did point out that because it's a very Republican state and conservative state, that they don't actually tax very much. And so most of their revenue comes from they don't tax corporations, or, you know, so their revenues are coming from, you know, activity like, you know, buying and selling, you know, regular retail activity. And that's not going on right now. So the state has taken a huge hit that way. And but they were kind of checking with the federal government to see if they could use some of the bailout money, the COVID bailout money, federal money to shore up that. But she said that basically they were told that they couldn't do it for mismanagement, which I think she was characterizing this sort of thing of not taxing corporations as a form of mismanagement that really, really hurts them when most of their revenue comes from sales tax and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And again, 503-231-8187. We only have 20 minutes left. So if you do want to get a call or comment in, you better do it right now and not wait for the last 5 minutes. Sonia, anything else?
Hello.
So let's hear from Sonia if there's any other callers or comments.
No one has, not yet.
Okay. Just put it out there, 503-231-8187. You were saying, Jackie?
Yeah. So the so it's an interesting time in South Dakota. I think that that definitely we're seeing another manifestation. You know, my book Standoff is actually supposed to be coming out, but since it's the pandemic, they've the publisher and the distributor have put off the actual release of the book. So I'm actually working on rewriting the last two chapters. And really to look at, I'm watching very carefully this issue of this armed response to stay-at-home orders. And I don't know if you've been watching Ammon Bundy, but he lives near Boise, Idaho, and he's been calling people to come to meetings. He's been holding meetings in his, he owns some sort of building, and basically in defiance of the governor's orders, and actually getting people to sign a document like he loves to have people do, to promise that they would come with their guns if the governor tries to enforce a stay-at-home order through actual, you know, legal means, to basically defend people's right to, you know, to be at liberty from these things. So definitely, I think I do wonder to what extent that plays a role here in South Dakota. I know that on the Navajo Nation, reporting from there, that the sort of reporting of Native people as being highly infected with COVID-19 definitely is good to, you know, to watch out for, you know, the vulnerabilities of the population, but it also feeds into incredibly racist ideas that particularly people in white people in border towns bordering the reservations hold. And so last month we had a white man living in Page, Arizona, which is just bordering the Navajo Nation, and basically put a call out on Facebook that people should, in his community, should try to kill Navajos because Navajos are 100% infected with COVID-19. And he was arrested for this. And obviously,
very Christian of him.
Yes. And so, but it definitely, it does worry me. I mean, the sort of messaging that, you know, I know it's very important to deal with the issues of the lack of infrastructure on the reservation, all these things, but what is it telling in these, in these sort of states where people have very racist views of Native Americans? And I have to say, with Standing Rock, a lot of Navajos came up to, you know, support Standing Rock, and it was the first time they'd really been in North Dakota, and they were shocked because they said the level of racism there in Bismarck and those communities is far higher than on the Navajo Nation, you know, in the border towns. They're not used to that level of scrutiny. They weren't used to being treated that badly, you know, and the racism was much worse in North Dakota than in than Arizona and New Mexico and Utah. And so it's so it does make me wonder, you know, do all these things saying that Native people are vulnerable, you know, is it telling racist people that Native people are diseased and are a threat to their community? And mm-hmm. And so I wonder, you know, and also there is this notion, like I was talking about the Atlantic Monthly article about that it's a disposable population of unwanted people who are dying, so it's okay. It's thinning the flock of people that they already have decided politically are not necessary. I mean, people from what Trump has called, you know, what kind of countries he's called them. I can't say the word, right? And why can't we have more people from Norway? You know, why do we have these people? You know, and so when you have, you know, I think that the rates for African Americans or Black Americans who are dying would be far higher. I think I had read in New York City like 50% of the fatalities, COVID-related fatalities, are of Black citizens of New York. It's so at that point you wonder, you know, when it's a white problem, then it gets a lot of attention. You know, these bailouts. And when they actually looked at where a lot of the money went to, the bailout money for the COVID money, a lot of it went to these red states that have very low, don't have a lot of issues with the outbreak, or at least that we know of. They're not doing testing. That's the other aspect, is that without testing, we don't know the actual scope of the problem. And with states doing different types of testing, different levels, it's very hard to compare the numbers. You know, if you're doing a lot of testing, you're going to have high numbers. If you don't do testing, then you won't know how big the problem is. And actually, South Dakota, with its you know, with the, its huge outbreak in Sioux Falls, but they have quite a growing sort of you know, I think they were second highest new cases, COVID cases per day in the country among states. And but you know, when it's in the minority communities that are at risk, the white communities can kind of say, well, that's not our problem. We can go back to work. We can do our thing. You know, that's their problem. And since, you know, since the Indian problem and, you know, the immigrant problem, you know, if you're looking at the workers at the meat pack, the meat factory, I think it's Smithfield in Sioux Falls, you know, it's then they're a population that we're not entirely happy to even have around. So why not, you know? It's, I don't know, these are...
Until the supply chain for meat completely breaks down, and then they'll, I don't know what they'll do, but they certainly do seem to be convenient for these big meat packing plants that are enabled by this executive order by Trump to continue operations without having to really place any strict guidelines and oversight. It's quite a dramatic situation, and we're about 15 minutes from the end. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland. I'm speaking with Jacqueline Keeler, who's my regular co-host on the second Wednesday. Number again is 503-231-8187. Let me just check back in with Sonia, see if anybody's
actually
on the line waiting.
We do have Camilo sharing channel one with you right now. Camilo, go ahead with your question.
Hi, thank you. I'm appreciating this discussion, but I want to ask you to try to reframe it in terms of the presidential election. And my concern is, and I think it was really expressed by Naomi Klein in Democracy Now!, is that the difference between the Democratic and the Republican Party is really not so significant. I mean, I don't support Trump. I want to see him eliminated. But I think if he's replaced by a corporate Democrat, it's not going to be so different. And I think that, you know, probably the golden boy, Andrew Cuomo, as was discussed in Democracy Now!, is a likely candidate for the Democratic Party, because Biden is really not going to you're not going to be able to beat Trump, I don't think, even with the pandemic and the economy. But you know, what are the implications of your discussion for how you view the election? Is Trump so bad that we should join forces with whoever it is that's nominated to elect them? I don't think it'll be any better for the situation in Indian country.
Well, actually, it's you know, I do understand and appreciate the arguments about, you know, these two very corporate parties and the lack of difference. I mean, when you look at the pipelines, certainly it took a lot of effort to get Obama's administration to finally take a strong stance on the Dakota Access Pipeline. For years, of course, Hillary Clinton supported the Keystone XL pipeline. And so certainly we see that in Indian country as well, that there is this sort of, these are both different aspects of the corporate interest. But as far as, you know, Trump's administration and the policies that he's enacting in Indian country, they are incredibly, it is very different from where we left off at the end of the gains that we had gotten fought for in 2016, particularly with the Dakota Access Pipeline. One of the first acts that Trump did when he got into office was to sign executive order, basically, I guess, encouraging, giving the permits back to the Dakota Access Pipeline and sending, you know, saying that he supported the Keystone XL Pipeline, which had been dead for years, you know, restarting that again. And so, and these pipelines are ongoing now, even as we speak. The tribe did win, you know, the right to have an environmental review recently. That was a really great win. But at the same time, the EPA has been gutted. You know, the destruction of these sorts of you know, the rollback of environmental issues has been extensive. I mean, and the environmental enforcement regulations. And of course, when you look at Bears Ears, you know, I edited a book about that, the creation of the National Monument in southeastern Utah, the homeland of five different Native nations, Trump, at the end of his first year in office, basically reduced that monument by 85%. And so removing protections from that over 120,000 antiquity sites, including many cliff dwellings, large structures, which are being pillaged right now and sold on eBay. So it's and then of course, you know, the other issues, which is that he is basically sending messages from the Oval Office to basically racists, emboldening them to take and look at what he's emboldened this governor to do, and she's doing this to perform for him, regardless of the cost of the lawsuit, regardless of the and the long term also issues with the he's been able to basically completely change the he's appointed more judges than they ever allowed Obama to do. He's impacted the jurisdictional system of our country for generations to come, and so it's the tribes rely on these jurisdictional decisions, as we're noting. We're basically citing different case law, right? In Indian federal law, and all of the federally recognized tribes in the country all have to abide by the same set of precedents set in this constitutional law called Indian federal law. And so what happens to one tribe, a decision, then when it goes to the Supreme Court, it affects all of us, all 574 federally recognized tribes. So we take very close attention to what happens at the Supreme Court, what happens at these circuit courts. And so it's what happened on Tuesday, or maybe it was Monday, actually the Supreme Court heard a case basically with the Creek Nation seeking to get clarification on its the status of its reservation in Oklahoma, which has been covered quite a bit, and although inaccurately in the Washington Post it was described as returning the land to the reservation, but because the reservation had not been disestablished, the point is that the land is not being returned, it's being acknowledged as being under the actual jurisdiction of the Creek Nation. It's a pretty large chunk of the state of Oklahoma, so this is why it's such a big deal. And so we really depend on these appointments, these legal appointments, to basically get a sort of legal decisions that protect our interests, our land base, our people, all of these things, our sovereignty. And so it's not a great position to be in. It's not ideal. It's not what I would want, having to turn to basically a foreign court to assert our own. But that's where, real politics, where we are right now. The other issues with the Trump administration have to do with that he appears to be actually pursuing a policy of termination of tribes. He has long personal grudges against Indian tribes in the Northeast with the casinos. He, I believe, holds them responsible for his own financial implosion in the 1990s with his casino operations, and has been outspoken about thinking they're not Indian enough for him, just based on how he thinks that Indians are supposed to be. And so we do see some signs that he is carrying that over in his administration of the of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We have the Assistant Secretary, her name is Tara Sweeney, and she is she has spent her life working for the Alaska Native Corporation. She is Alaska Native. What happened in Alaska was that instead of being sovereign nations, what they did was they turned the tribes and the Alaska Native communities into corporations for the purpose of the oil, right, of managing oil resources. So she has actually been a lobbyist for opening up ANWR. And so we're very careful watching how this impacts her administration and her service to Trump, to the Trump administration, as a member of the Trump administration. And we've gotten some pretty disturbing things. He took some land out of trust that has not happened before. you know, with the Mashpee Wampanoag, which were the Wampanoag were the tribe that actually met the Pilgrims at Plymouth Rock, right? And they had land in trust, basically their reservation that they were looking at putting a casino on, right? And so he took that land out of trust, which has never happened before, which is a step towards terminating the tribe as a federally recognized tribe. And then also with the CARES money, the $8 billion, there was no mechanism to disperse the money. So the tribes have not received any of the federal funding to deal with the epidemic with the COVID-19 crisis. So the tribes are funding this out of their own, like the Navajo Nation, all of their efforts that they're doing are completely out of their own pocket. They have not been reimbursed at all. And most tribes have had to close down their casinos, which is a major, economic engine for many, many tribes. And they've had to close that down and basically continue to pay staff out of their own pocket. And so there has been a challenge. Actually, the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe and the Ogallala Sioux tribe, who Governor Noem is challenging their right to have COVID checkpoints in South Dakota, they are actually party to a lawsuit suing the government over the CARES Act and the funding, the tribal funding, because Tara Sweeney, as Alaskan Native Corporation officer, she basically managed, we think, to get almost half of the money of the $8 billion sent to Alaska Native corporations. And, Alaska Native population is only a tiny portion of the Native, of the tribal population in the United States, yet they received almost 50% of the money. And they are corporations, they are not sovereign nations. So it's there's a lot of issues, and their main corporate interest is oil, transporting oil out of the Anwar, and so it's a very complicated issue. He presents a real clear and present danger to tribal sovereignty, to our safety in this case with the CARES funding, and also to the preservation of our history with the elimination of Bear's Ears. So it's very obvious that his goal is to basically cause as much damage to tribal interests as he can while he's in office.
Well, put in my two cents about Camilo's question. I had Norman Solomon on a couple weeks ago, who basically put it starkly as a supporting, if Biden does go through as a nominee, supporting a more neoliberalism versus supporting neo-fascism, and you've given a whole other important take on it from indigenous perspective, which is often not seen because people aren't often focusing on those issues. So we really appreciate that perspective. We've got about 3 minutes left. We've covered a lot of stuff here again with Jacqueline Keeler, writer and activist locally here, who has repeat your new podcast. It's thepollennation.com. That's thepollen pollen.
It's Pollination Magazine. Sorry. It's actually pollennationmagazine.com.
Oh, I was looking at someone. That's right. That's a different. That's a whole different website. I'm sorry. Pollen Nation Magazine.
Yeah, pollen as in corn pollen. And so it's pollen, P-O-L-L-E-N, nation, as in nation, magazine.com. So it's actually a news magazine that was started by myself and other Native women journalists. And we're seeking to deepen the conversation, and we have been doing these podcasts 3 times a week, and actually doing them on Facebook Live on our Pollination Magazine Facebook page. So you can definitely check that out. We have an event page for these for the Pollination Coronavirus Podcast, which you can look up and get sign up for and get notices every time we're going to go live. We go live at 1:30 Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And so Monday, our show was about we had Chairman Frazier. We were talking about the 48-hour demand letter sent by the governor with no time frame. I mean, the letter was also undated, so the Chairman Frazier said they didn't even know what time Sunday that it expired. they never received a copy of the letter either. So it and then also today we're going to be actually talking about the $8 billion CARES fund, which a lot of tribes have entered into lawsuits over with the federal government because there was no tool, no pathway to actually distribute it. And although about the first a little over $4 billion have been distributed now, but the remainder remains, actually there's an injunction against distributing it because it's to the Alaskan Native tribes, so corporations. So we're going to discuss that. And then on Friday, we're actually talking about mutual aid, which I think you would find interesting because one of the things that has really come out of this, and when I was on assignment with Sierra Magazine, my article's there now, it's called The Fundamental Law, which is a part of the Navajo Constitution, which references our traditional Navajo concepts. And Navajos, we didn't really have a government before. We didn't even have chiefs. We didn't have chiefs until we had to fight the Americans, right, organized that way. We were anarchists. I mean, in a very real sense, we lived in a state of anarchy. Held together, our laws were the laws of kinship, of relationship to one another. And so people lived very independently. And so when I was on the assignment, I interviewed not only Navajos who supported participating in the electoral process, but also Navajos who challenged the idea as well. That didn't really get in the final piece, but one of the things that was brought up to me by Cleve Anali, who is a Navajo anarchist, is,
well, I think, and I also think we're gonna have to hold it okay. there and let people tune in today, 1:30 to Pollen Nation podcast, and that's PollenNationMagazine.com, and that's it for today. Thanks, Jackie, so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Paul Rowland signing off with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks, Sonia.
If you got the sense to take care of your source of perfection.